From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Home cooking. For many of us, it's been a cloud hovering over this pandemic. Like it or hate it, it's the task that won't go away, along with all those dishes that follow. How we cook at home was on my mind when I reached out to writer and avid home cook Roxane Gay, but our conversation quickly became personal.
There's so much stigma around food, no matter how you consume it as a fat person. And I think that's where at least my work lies.
One of my fascinations with food is how it can be both a balm and a torment. For those of us who seek comfort in food and protection in fat, we ride that edge nearly every minute of every day. Roxane Gay's brilliant book, Hunger, is a confessional of personal trauma and a searing societal indictment of how we are judged. It's an account of what it feels like to be in her body, a body that experienced childhood abuse, and how the subsequent trauma created a need for the kind of self-protection that overeating can provide. For many of us, the act of cooking is a bridge between ourselves and others and between different parts of ourselves. Following Roxane's cooking journey on Twitter has been a joy. Hi.
Hello.
I'm so happy to get to talk to you.
Oh, thank you.
What was the food like in your house growing up?
The food was good. You know, my mom does not necessarily have a passion for cooking, but she does have a passion for her family. And so she made Haitian food and some American food. It was very much the sort of food triangle type of making sure we had the proper nutrition. Everything was well balanced. She didn't believe in processed foods. So I actually never really ate canned food. I've never had a frozen dinner, things like that. And, you know, she just put a lot of energy into making sure we were well fed.
Did your mom teach you to cook?
No, she did not. She specifically did not teach me to cook because she didn't want me cooking after some man.
I just think that's so evolved. It's shocking.
I mean, she's quite the feminist. She says she's not a feminist, but she's incredibly feminist. She did teach my brother to cook, though.
That, I mean, which is also hilarious in its own way.
Yes.
Yes. So it's perfectly possible to go through this life, particularly now, without learning how to cook. Why did you want to?
I started teaching myself how to cook when I moved to Charleston, Illinois for my first faculty position, and I was a vegetarian at the time. And vegetarian cuisine, especially in Charleston at that time, was largely iceberg lettuce and French fries. And as delicious as that sounds, it's not a way to live and it's not sustainable. And so I realized that if I was going to eat anything remotely nutritious or delicious, I was going to have to make it myself. And so I started to learn how to cook.
And who was your mentor? Did you have one?
No, I did not. Well, I guess Ina Garten. I watched a lot of Food Network, and Ina is definitely my guiding light in terms of the culinary realm.
And also as a woman, I understand.
Yeah, I think she's an incredible role model for women, and in that she's very self-possessed, very confident, and she never shines away from her talent, which is always really nice to see in a woman.
So what's comfort food for you?
I'm not sure. You know, I think all food is comfort food for me. So it's not, there's not a specific thing that I turn to for comfort. I just turn to food. It doesn't matter what it is.
I find it really interesting that in our society, we're allowed to cook while fat, but eating while fat is another thing entirely.
For sure, for sure. You know, there's a lot of stigma around eating while fat. And also, I think, and to a certain extent, around cooking while fat. You know, there's always going to be someone who's going to make a comment like, why are you making that? You know, go get some gruel and shut up. And it's frustrating. Like, people don't want you to eat. They don't want to see you eating because so many people deprive themselves. And so they resent seeing fat people eat when they think that we should make ourselves suffer the way they are suffering and restricting even though what they don't realize is that most fat people are constantly engaged in some form of disordered eating.
A lot of thin people, too.
Oh, for sure. But I don't care about them.
One of my favorite lines in Hunger is that when you say you ate that thin woman and she was delicious, but unsatisfying.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, I think disordered eating is disordered eating no matter what kind of body you're in. There's enough people worrying about and caring about thin people. I care about fat people more just because a lot of times fat people have eating disorders and they go untreated because people don't think you can be fat and have an eating disorder. And there's so much stigma around food, no matter how you consume it as a fat person. And I think that's where at least my work lies. Because there are so many advocates out there doing great work for thin people.
You wrote about your decision to have bariatric surgery in an essay titled What Fullness Is. And you wrote, quote, "I hate the way I hunger, but never find satisfaction. I want and want and want, but never allow myself to reach for what I truly want, leaving that want raging desperately beneath the surface of my skin," unquote. Does cooking abate that wanting somewhat?
It can, because I feel more in control and I get to feel like I'm having a healthy relationship with food because I'm taking the time and I'm caring enough about myself and my family to prepare something. And so it does make the tension and the stress of what is normally my relationship with food a lot easier to control.
Can we talk for a minute about what fullness is? You, it's the title of that essay you wrote, and I just think those three words contain so much to think about, because so much of, well, I know for me, for sure, so much of my relationship with food is about where my brain is on a given day and my emotional self, and has nothing to do with how much or how little I put into my body. Did fullness change for you once you had surgery?
Oh, for sure. Because for the first time in my adult life, I felt fullness physically. I didn't necessarily feel it emotionally, but because I felt it physically, I was able to consider that perhaps I was sated, which is not something I had previously been able to experience for whatever reason.
I wish they would find out that reason.
Yeah, I think it would be, well, I think part of it is that I ignored that feeling of fullness, but with the surgery, the restriction is such that, the physical restriction is such that you really do feel it, and you do feel incredible discomfort if you try to push past that point.
Were you afraid of the pushback you would get after being such a voice for fat positive messaging?
Yeah, I was certainly concerned because it's a pretty touchy subject, weight loss surgery in the fat positivity community. And I've never claimed to be the spokesperson of that community, but I do believe that fat positivity is incredibly important. And I think that we need to change how we see fatness, how we treat fat people, and that we cannot frame it as a negative. It's an adjective. It is a type of body. And there are all kinds of reasons for a fat body, but it doesn't matter. You don't have to explain a fat body. And so I knew that there were going to be people who felt like I was betraying something, but I was the only person who knew what it was like to live in my body at that size. And so I made a decision because eventually I feel like my luck was going to run out. Eventually I was going to have some sort of issue that was only going to be exacerbated by age. And so I wanted to just try something different. And who knows if it will work, but, you know, it was worth a try, and I have no regrets.
That was writer Roxane Gay, author of a number of best-selling books, including Bad Feminists, Difficult Women, and Hunger. Coming up, it's never been easier to cook a plant-based diet. We talk about the history of veganism and how exactly to cook jackfruit at home. Next.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Good Food. Growing up, I was no stranger to hippie food and was part of the first generation to request alfalfa sprouts in my avocado sandwich. So I've always found my own personal reticence towards veganism kind of fascinating. For years, vegans got a bad rap, and there were reasons for this. The movement was alienating and splintered. But that's in the past. The trifecta of animal rights, environment, and health has caused many to take their worries about livestock production to a dietary solution. And now, as concerns over the availability and price of meat during the pandemic rise, Americans are finding alternatives for getting their protein. Jonathan Kaufman reported on the rise in popularity of vegan chefs and their recipes for the Wall Street Journal. Hi, Jonathan.
Hey, how's it going, Evan?
Good. How about you?
I'm all right.
Are you a vegetarian or a vegan?
No, I'm not. I am married to a vegetarian, and I'm the cook of the household. So we do eat vegetarian at home, but in my normal life, I eat everything.
Do you know what percentage of Americans consider themselves vegan?
I don't. The figures are relatively conflicting, but they range between 1 and 2 or 3%. There was a recent survey that came out from Gallup that said that the vegetarian population, in their poll, said that the 5% of the Americans considered themselves vegetarian or vegan. But what was really interesting about that poll is within that, 3% of white respondents said they were vegan or vegetarian, and 9% of non-white respondents called themselves vegetarian or vegan.
That's fascinating. Also, I have to say, as a person centered in California, it's just shocking that it's that low, because I think for us, it's a very different world.
Yeah, it reminds me how different the West Coast is from everywhere, east of the Mississippi.
Right. Can you talk to us a bit about the history of plant-based eating and cooking? I know there have been signposts of cookbooks along the way, which have really shifted things for a lot of folks.
Well, the very, very deep history of vegan cooking in the United States really is in Los Angeles, where the first raw food restaurant in America opened up in the 19-teens, called the Eutrophian. But that's, raw food was, it had this little blip of interest in the 1910s and 1920s. Nobody started using the word vegan in the States until probably the late 70s or early 80s. In 1968, there was this cookbook that came out of the Seventh-day Adventists called 10 Talents. And that was one of the first cookbooks to offer recipes for making nut milks and using nutritional yeast as a cheese substitute. And it was a book that kind of circulated among vegetarians and really provided the template for how vegans would eat for the next 20 years. And then in the 80s and 90s, the, hardcore punk scene really kind of merged with the animal rights movement and formed that sort of activist-oriented vegan kind of identity that we, a lot of people still think represents all vegans today.
And then, of course, there was the Nation of Islam,
mm-hmm.
and that cookbook, which changed everything for a certain segment of African Americans.
Mm-hmm. There was a lot of conversation in the late 60s around that emerged out of Black Panthers and the Nation of Islam about how unhealthy food is a form of oppression. And it comes out of sort of an industrial food system that is part of the entire economy that oppresses African-Americans and specifically oppresses their health. And so eating well and eating a plant-based diet, that idea kind of emerged out of that movement and really took hold maybe 20, 30 years on.
So let's talk about the newer way that plant-based eating is presented through social media and contemporary cookbooks. I find it fascinating how all of a sudden the shift has been towards these very engaging, seductive, beautiful images of plant-based foods that seem to be simultaneously touching on farmers' markets, an internationalized way of cooking. Could you maybe talk about Rachel Ama and the realization she had?
So Rachel Ama is a Londoner in her late 20s, and she's one of this generation of YouTube stars who she converted to veganism driven by, you know, sort of concerns over the environment and animal welfare and health. But when she was trying to educate herself about what she should eat, she found that, you know, most of the recipes around her were like either sort of salad-y, health food oriented stuff, or, you know, it felt very bland to her and it didn't represent her own family background, which is a mix of West African and Caribbean, or the background of the folks she grew up with and the food she was seeing around her in London. And so she began recording these videos and, you know, there's a low barrier to entry. YouTube allowed her to sort of just emerge as this personality, and she's really one of the most engaging of this new generation of YouTube stars. And so she has like 400 something thousand viewers and a cookbook that came out, and her recipes are bright and colorful and flavorful, and she is a joy to watch. And so she brings in an audience that she says, you know, really isn't necessarily vegan at all. They're folks who just enjoy engaging with her on television and like the look of her recipes.
Yeah, I find this kind of Trojan horse way of engaging with plant-based foods really, really interesting. In November of 2018, you wrote about the San Francisco restaurant Namugaji and mm-hmm. and how they had quietly moved their menu to embrace a vegan ethos. I found that article really fascinating because I think it speaks very much to what's going on these days.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating when I go out, or when I used to go out, that, you know, more and more, obviously, I'm going out with a vegetarian, and so my husband and I are looking for dishes that are more plant-oriented, but more and more menus are structured in a way where it tends to be a more small plates format. And many of the small plates are really focused on, at a certain level of, you know, sort of price level, certain genre of restaurant. A lot of the vegetable dishes are vegan. And they're just very quietly vegan because there are cooks, you know, chefs and restaurateurs want to appeal to the broadest number of diners. And so if they're going to offer a vegetarian dish, why not make it a vegan dish? Because that way you sort of make sure you're serving everybody who's at the table.
And that to me is the shift, because it seems like the conversation about vegan food for years was stuck in this protein place. So yeah. That we're always talking about ersatz, what to meat eaters who, you know, who would like to be converted perhaps, is seen as an ersatz product, something maybe made in a lab or that requires technology to produce that is taking the place of meat.
Mm-hmm. And I think that leads out of both, you know, sort of we've absorbed the message of studies like the China study, which book that came out about 15 years ago that was authored by T. Colin Campbell and Thomas Campbell. It was about a study in China that compared, you know, the health of some folks over 20 years and found that people who eat meat had higher levels of heart disease, diabetes, certain kinds of cancer. And so the message started trickling out that eating plant-based foods and not worrying about protein is more healthy for us. And I think that also this, it's, you know, we particularly see it on the West Coast. And I hear this from talking to chefs, the vegetables, the produce here is so gorgeous that why not just focus on that?
So despite this focus on vegetables and our bounty, which we're so lucky to have here, all of these plant-based protein alternatives are making it into the mainstream, appearing on fast food menus like Burger King and Dunkin' Donuts. How have sales grown over the last couple of years for plant-based foods? And do sales reflect not non-vegans dipping into that pool occasionally?
In fact, I think that's the biggest percentage of sales. You know, in this growth in sales are from omnivores who want to eat more plant-based alternatives. According to the Plant-Based Foods Association, sales of all plant-based foods have grown, annual sales have grown from $3.9 billion to $5 billion in just 2 years. And a huge part of that is plant-based dairy. Almond milk, soy milk, rice milk, they are now so intertwined with dairy milk in a lot of dairy sections and refrigerated cases that you have to kind of look at the container to make sure you're getting what you want to be getting. But also, plant-based meat folks, when you talk to the founders of companies like Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat, they both say their goal isn't to appeal to vegans. Their goal is to appeal to omnivores.
So fascinating. This has been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me on.
That was journalist Jonathan Kaufman. We've been talking about the progression of vegan cooking over the last 100 years and just how easy it has become to eat plant-based at home. I don't think it's a secret that Mexican food's my favorite food. It's the food I begged for as a kid and still crave every day. It's also not a secret that I'm an omnivore who respects the lard. But the first time I had food that Jocelyn Ramirez prepared was at an event that Todo Verde catered. It was a wake-up call for me to expand my palate and my understanding of plant-based food. Jocelyn has a new book that shows us how to do just that. Hi, Jocelyn.
Hi, Evan. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Tell us about the food that you ate growing up. Who was doing the cooking and what was on the table?
Well, the person who was typically cooking in our household growing up was my mother, who's from Zacatecas, Mexico. And the cuisine that we ate was usually guisados that included things like verdolagas or nopales in some sort of a stew with chilies and maybe some pieces of meat. And that was typically what was on the table, frijoles de la olla, freshly cooked beans straight out of the pot. But my mom also worked full-time, oftentimes overtime. And so that meant that my brother and I were latchkey kids and would also eat a lot of fast food in the neighborhood. Or if my mom was really tired, she'd pick up, the healthier fast food like El Pollo Loco or Subway. So, things on the table really ranged day to day depending on how tired she was.
Until very recently, so much of the visibility around veganism and plant-based diets has occurred in mostly white spaces. Did you find that your family and your community was quick to accept this idea of vegan Mexican food?
They actually were not at first. I think that, your comment about it being something that people mostly consider to be a diet, a plant-based diet, is something that people in a white community most gravitate towards. Or if you tell, somebody in a Mexican household that we're going to be eating a vegan XYZ dish, they think that you're going to give them a kale salad or, something that doesn't resonate with the culture. And, one thing that I've really tried to do with Todo Verde is to create plant-based dishes that definitely are culturally relevant, that are rooted in the food and tradition that we have eaten for generations. And, you know, tradition is also a concept that I like to question and consider a bit further because, you know, our traditions have evolved. Our ancestors ate a mostly plant-forward diet that did include meat consumption around special ceremonies. But now, you know, a special ceremony in a Mexican household might just be, you know, like, you know, every cousin's birthday requires a carne asada. And, you know, and that has really strayed away from the way that our ancestors have eaten. So I'm really trying to bring back, like, what does tradition really mean and how has that evolved over time? And can we find this in between that makes sense with, you know, our ecosystem and our culture?
Is that what you mean when you advocate decolonizing your diet?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when people think about our, you know, Mexican culture, they think that, you know, if the pozole doesn't have chicken or pork in it, it's not a quote unquote real pozole, which is so untrue because pozole was a dish that was eaten by, you know, our ancient ancestors for many, many generations. And they ate that with before we had pork or chicken available to us on this land. And so, yeah, I definitely have people really go back and, you know, put on their critical thinking caps and think more towards, like, what does tradition really mean? And how, you know, how did our ancestors eat in a decolonized way or prior to colonization that prevented a lot of these issues that we deal with now, like diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, cancer, in mostly low-income communities of color.
Let's talk about a few recipes. Is there one in particular that you think is a great recipe for skeptics?
Yeah, well, I think that some of the dishes that I've seen a lot of people on our Instagram gravitate towards are definitely the jackfruit dishes, mostly because they have a look, feel, texture of a meat dish, similar to a shredded pork or chicken. And, you know, people have been making our carnitas tacos, the al pastor tacos featured in the book. You know, maybe someone may not right away turn to a three sister salad as an everyday dish, you know, which is an ancestral dish, but they've been eating tacos, you know, many days of the week throughout their life. So maybe a carnita style dish made with jackfruit or an al pastor dish will be an easy substitute.
Okay, so explain jackfruit to me. What is it and where do I find it?
Sure. So jackfruit is a tropical fruit. It grows on trees as big as watermelons. They typically have big green spikes all over them. And they usually grow in tropical areas in Asian countries or in Mexico. And by the time they get exported here to the United States, they're typically already ripe and sweet. They have a really delicious, tropical, unique flavor. But if you want to cook jackfruit in a savory dish like the ones in the book, you have to purchase what they call young green jackfruit, which means that the jackfruit has been cultivated and broken down before the sugars have developed. So you will find it usually in either a can or in a pouch that's vacuum sealed, and it's essentially preserved so that it doesn't ripen into the sweet tropical fruit. And it cooks really, really easily in just a little bit of oil and that delicious seasoning and whatever you'd like to flavor it in.
And it has this amazing quality, kind of like tofu, where it just absorbs flavor. So it can be many different things.
It's almost like a blank palette, and you can add anything to it, just like a tofu. And I think that what people enjoy more with jackfruit than I have seen with the tofu is just the textural difference, because it really does crisp up and has this, you know, pulled pork or shredded chicken feel.
So if we were going to make a jackfruit al pastor, how would we start?
Well, I'd like to break down the jackfruit from, there's two different components of it in a piece of jackfruit. There's this core piece that's a little bit more, it doesn't shred the same way that the other pieces of the jackfruit do, but they taste just like every bit of the jackfruit. It tastes the same. So I like to mince that up and still include it in the dish so that it doesn't become waste. And then once you get the jackfruit all broken down into smaller bits, I like to bring in a marinade of, for the al pastor, I would bring in a marinade of achiote, pineapple juice, a little bit of orange juice, lots of cumin, which I like to use in a lot of my dishes to create a little bit of depth of flavor. And you can add in other things that are typical or traditional al pastor dishes to your family to bring in this flavorful marinade to the dish. And then you would cook it in a little bit of oil in a saute pan or on a plancha until it crisps up. And it typically takes about 20, 25 minutes to get there. And I bring in diced pineapple towards the end of the cooking so that you have those fresh bits of pineapple in there, just like you would in any al pastor taco. And I'll lastly top it off with a little bit of salsa de aguacate, a little bit of fresh cilantro, and have it all on a fresh handmade tortilla.
That sounds extremely delicious. So to be honest, I think the first thing that made me want to explore your food was my first sip of one of your aguas. They're such a simple drink, but yours are really next level. It's about to get warm here. Can you share some of your agua secrets with us?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that the most popular agua fresca that we have on our menu is our amorcito. And I didn't include that one in the book, but I'll give a little sneak peek on the ingredients in that particular agua fresca. It's a strawberry drink with chia seeds and maple syrup. The chia seeds provide great texture in the agua. And we add rose to it to infuse this really floral, delicious element to the drink. And it is just everyone's favorite, the amorcito, strawberry rose. And we also have a black rice horchata, which is included in the cookbook. And it's made with black rice, which actually is purple when you blend it. It doesn't stay black. And so we add activated charcoal to our agua fresca to then make it black and add all of the other traditional horchata flavors like Mexican cinnamon, maple syrup. I add chia seeds to all of our agua fresca because chia seeds are something that was included in agua fresca for many, many generations, and a little bit of vanilla. And so they're really simple, but because we use just really good ingredients, the flavors really shine through.
Thank you so much, Jocelyn. It's a lovely book. And thank you for coming to talk to us today.
Thank you so much, Evan. I really appreciate it.
That was Jocelyn Ramirez. Her book is La Vida Verde, Plant-Based Mexican Cooking with Authentic Flavor. In a minute, what does it mean to decolonize your spice cabinet? Find out when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. My spice cabinet is less a cabinet and more a closet, absolutely filled to the brim. And if I were to categorize the cuisines represented, I would say that I probably have more from the country of India than anywhere else, which is one reason why I was so intrigued to learn about Sana Javeri Kadri and her spice company, Diaspora. We figured, since you're getting up close and personal with your pantries, it would be good to learn about what goes into sourcing and marketing high-quality spices. Hi, Sana.
Hi, Evan. So lovely to be here.
Oh, it's so great to finally get to have this conversation. I've been wanting to talk to you for so long.
It's been long overdue.
Yes. When you created your original Kickstarter in 2017, you stated that your mission was to, quote, disrupt and decolonize the spice supply chain. Can you explain?
Yeah, trust a millennial to come out with some big statements. So essentially, the spice trade for the past hundreds of years has usually been in the hands of colonizers, so the Dutch, the Portuguese, the British. The spice trade actually has existed without the colonizers for thousands of years, but on a much smaller scale. It was colonialism that really turned it into the highly profitable global industry that we know it as today. And the British in India were the most successful at it. So the way that the British set it up, they set it up so that they were seeing profits of about 300x, which is unheard of. And so their intention was not so much to, you know, bring the highest quality pepper that was grown on a beautiful farm in Kerala to their consumers in England. It was more to create this idea of a luxury good. And so to create kind of a aura of luxury and myth around black pepper as it was the equivalent of a Louis Vuitton handbag. So if you had, you know, black in the 1800s, if you had black pepper in your pantry or in your kitchen, you were deemed upper class or a person of status. So as 150 years later, unfortunately, the same quality standards that were put into place by the British or the Portuguese or the Dutch continued, where spices were mostly bought and sold by traders for size and for color. So they were not bought on the basis of flavor, aroma, harvest year. So to give you an example, a lot of people think that Malabar pepper is this, or Tellicherry pepper are these wonderful varieties of pepper. Whereas in reality, Malabar pepper is a big pepper. Tellicherry pepper is a slightly smaller peppercorn. And so farmers from all over India have to give their harvests over to be measured, and they get money based on measurement. And that's not actually, it doesn't actually have anything to do with which true botanical variety of pepper it was, what flavor profiles those peppers had, where it was grown, so terroir. So in terms of decolonizing, one, I wanted to bring a new level of equity to these farmers, where this, I wanted to make sure that that 300x profit could actually go directly to farmers and not just to the traders. So we act as the exporter and the importer. I spend half the year in India, meeting up with small farmers all over India, and then I export their product to the United States as the exporter, and then I am also the importer. So that also means that we can work with any scale of farmer, as long as they're growing something very delicious. It doesn't matter whether they have capital, whether they have access to import-export bureaucracy. We will do that for them in the name of kind of righting a historical wrong and really championing for their products. And the decolonization angle comes from always using indigenous heirloom varieties and championing for those varieties. The way I often describe it is, currently, the spice trade says that all tomatoes are one kind of tomato because they're all red, whereas we know that there's heirloom tomatoes, there's sun goals, there's these different varieties that have different flavor profiles. We're trying to bring the same knowledge and understanding to spices.
When you initially got this idea for this business and you turned to Kickstarter to fund it, had you already met spice growers? Where did the idea come from?
So we started with 350 kilograms of turmeric from one farmer. I went back to Mumbai February 2017, and I visited about 40 different farms across India, primarily turmeric farms. That was my primary kind of research angle. And I visited the Indian Institute of Spices Research. And the Indian Institute of Spices Research is really the organization that's since been connecting me to these farms. So by 2017, I had connected to our turmeric farmer and a few cardamom farmers. And from there, you know, we've grown. I still make the sourcing visits every year and meet between anywhere from 20 to 40 farmers every year as we decide what we're going to keep bringing on.
And why was turmeric your first focus?
It was 2016. Turmeric was everywhere. It had turned into a huge trend. And honestly, my research into the company was wondering who was catering to the turmeric trend. Like, if everybody was suddenly consuming so much more turmeric, and it was this new audience of largely wellness folks who wanted an organic, kind of a high curcumin turmeric, then who was growing it? And I actually thought that maybe I would just shoot a photo series about the turmeric farmers that are supplying to your turmeric latte. But then the more I dug into the industry and the more I visited turmeric farms, I realized that actually the quality of turmeric that was going into these lattes was really, really low. And often they didn't have any curcumin in them. And curcumin is the anti-inflammatory good stuff. So it was an accidental thing of just wanting to research turmeric and then that taking me down this rabbit hole of realizing that the entire industry and aisle could do with some disruption.
There must be a vetting process on both sides, both for you to get to know the growers mm-hmm. and for them to get to know and to trust you. Has that been difficult?
Yeah, that's a very good question that I haven't been asked before. And, you know, I'm a young woman. I clearly seem westernized when I show up on these farms. I definitely have a lot more, respectability because I speak multiple Indian languages. I grew up in Mumbai. So that helps. That's a big advantage. But being a woman, being a young woman, not having a man around is difficult. And I've actually found that the growers that are very passionate about the way that they're growing, they're the ones that don't care who I am. They're the ones who really just see that where values align and that I'm really passionate about uplifting the work that they do as much as they're passionate about growing heirloom varieties, growing organically. I lied about my age for a long time, like for the first 3 years of the business. It's only now as I'm approaching 27 that I feel a little bit proud to be a young business owner. But for a long time, it was just me straight up saying, oh, right, I'm 30. I have a husband, you know, just going with that lie for as long as I could to be taken seriously.
As prolific turmeric users, the good food team has asked me to ask you this question. Uh-huh. How do you get the stains out, particularly of baby clothes?
That's a very good question. I get it more than you would think. So a great thing is to soak the baby clothes in a vinegar solution. So do 50% water, 50% vinegar. It is a lot of vinegar, and soak it for about an hour. That'll help. And so after the soaking, then you wash your clothes with soap. So with regular detergent or laundry detergent. And then you leave it out to dry in the harshest sunshine you can find. So after you've washed it, it'll probably still be, there'll be like a pale yellow stain. And that's when you leave it in the sunshine and the sunshine will actually fade the turmeric stain.
That is such good advice.
Now you know.
Now I know. What exciting work you're doing.
Thank you. Some days it's amazing. Some days not so much.
Well, sort of like the rest of us.
Yeah, like all of us. It's not as sourcing is really not as glamorous as people think. I think people think I'm Indiana Jones and it's really not that.
Well, you know, it is sexy to us. Well, thank you so much, Sana. It was great to finally have this conversation.
Yeah, thank you for having me and for slowing me down.
That is Sana Javeri Qadri. Her company is Diaspora. We go from dried spices to fresh herbs. Jillian Ferguson is at the Santa Monica Farmers Market with a look at what's in season this final week of May.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. Over the last few weeks, I've seen more and more chefs trickle back into the market. And I was very happy to see Jihee Kim, who is here shopping for a brand new project that she launched at the beginning of the month. It's called Perilla. Hi, Jihee.
Hi.
So tell us about this new project. What is Perilla?
So during this quarantine, I had a lot of time at home, so I started making a bunch of banchans after I come back from farmer's market every week to stock up my fridge, and I share with my friend. They had encouraged me to share with more people, so that's how I started it.
I love it. I love that this time is inspiring people to start new businesses. It's amazing.
Yeah, it was fast.
So does the menu change every week?
Yeah, it's we have a main dish, usually like doshirak, sort of like a Korean version of bento, and a rice bowl. And those two change every week. Also, I have a 5 different kind of banchan, and depends on what I get from market, it changes every week. Yeah.
Okay, so what's on the menu this week?
So this week we're doing a kimbap, which is a, it's like a sushi roll, but it's not sushi actually. It's a Korean version of a sushi roll, similar to futomaki in Japanese, I guess. But I make it really big. It's like almost same size as my fish.
Yeah, it almost looks like a burrito.
Actually, yeah, it could be almost as big as burrito, but I probably shouldn't make it as big as burrito. So we have one veg version has avocado and a mushroom, and another one has a steak in it. So we're selling that, and we have 5 different kind of banchan, which is tofu, tomato, bok choy, komatsuna, which is Japanese mustard spinach, and Thai shallot kimchi.
Yum, the Thai shallot kimchi. Yeah, you worked at Rustic Canyon.
Yeah.
And I know that you were quite famous for your Thai shallot kimchi there at Rustic Canyon, too.
Chef Jeremy asked me to make a vegan version, so I made it as vegan, but this one has fish sauce. I can't take the fish sauce out.
That's great. Okay, so you mentioned komatsuna, which is a Japanese mustard spinach. Who are you buying that from?
So I got it from Yasutomi Farm. So a couple weeks ago, Jake Yasutomi reached out to me, and he has a lot. If I want to pick up, I was like, yeah, for sure. And he said, you have to come to the farm. And I was like, oh, yeah, I would love to. And I got really excited. It actually takes only 20 to 30 minutes from where I live. So, yeah, I go there now every week to get komatsuna and lettuce.
And how do you prepare it?
So for komatsuna, I blanching it, leaf and stem separately because it require different cooking times. So I blanching it, shock it, dry it, and I season with doenjang, which is Korean soybean paste, and maesilchang, which is Korean green plum extract, raw garlic, and finish with sesame oil and sesame seed. It's very simple.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Jihee.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jihee Kim of the newly launched Perilla. She's offering farmers market inspired banchan for curbside pickup in Koreatown. Check out her project, Perilla, on Instagram. Every year in May and June, the Coleman Family Farms booth is quite literally overflowing with herbs and flowers. It's an absolute joy to see, especially right now. And I'm talking now with Romeo Coleman, who brings this incredible bouquet down from Carpinteria. Hi, Romeo.
Hi.
How are you?
Doing pretty good.
All right. So how did you come to grow this incredible variety of herbs?
Well, I was born into it by my dad's family business, and he always had all these herbs, crazy stuff. We'd always explain to people at farmers markets being little kids and growing up. We didn't really know any different.
I mean, just looking at it now, there's at least 25 herbs, different herbs on the table, and this is just a tiny fraction of what you grow. Can you take us down the table from maybe right to left and just tell us what you have right now?
Yeah, we have some basils coming into season. We have lemon basil, purple basil, Thai basil, also Italian, which is a normal variety everyone's used to. We have some Persian mint, which is really good in mojitos, very light flavored. Marjoram, lovage. Lovage is wonderful flavor in soups and salads. Lots of flavor, so use a little bit.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about what that flavor is.
It's similar to parsley, Italian parsley, but more aromatic. We also have papalo, which is really good. That's use it like a cilantro raw. You just eat it alongside your tacos or meat or whatever you want. We also have lots of nice green onions coming in. Radishes are bountiful right now. They're just starting to get a little spice or more spice. We have lots of blue borage flowers you can use in your drinks. A very cute thing you could do is freeze them into ice cubes and then, you know, make a little nice cute ice cube for your drinks.
I love that idea. I've never heard that before. And borage flowers, they have a taste a little bit like cucumber.
They have a slight cucumber flavor to them, yes.
What other flowers do you have right now?
We have cilantro flowers, which a lot of people use just as a bouquet, but they're edible as well. They're really good with raw fish or like crudo fish in ceviches. Oh, it's so good because it looks pretty, but it also tastes really good.
And the smell is just amazing.
Yeah, the smells are great with them.
So is this peak season for herbs and flowers for you?
This is the beginning of peak season. Yeah, May, we have a lot of stuff coming in. And then by the end of May, we have more stuff coming out. Like we'll have all our shiso, the purple shiso, Korean shiso, Japanese green shiso coming in. Our anise hyssop, which is very aromatic and great in drinks.
And how are things at the farm? Are you able to continue planting and harvesting at the same rate that you were this time last year?
We are still trying to figure out, like everybody else. I just kept our same planting schedule. I wanted to give it like at least 6 months to see if I needed to change anything. And hopefully by that time, I'll get back into a normal swing of things. But through this time, we found out that we need to plant more of some of the staple, more staple things that we have.
Yeah, well, today, for me at least, the market is feeling a little bit more vibrant. I'm seeing more and more familiar faces, and just the energy feels really good.
Yeah, people have gotten used to the new protocol, and we're, you know, we're all embracing it as much as we can.
Well, we're so happy that you have stuck with it and you're here every week. Thank you, Romeo.
Thank you.
That was Romeo Coleman of Coleman Family Farms. He comes down from Carpinteria with an incredible variety of herbs, flowers, and row crops. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
Up next, have you noticed that your morning coffee filter looks an awful lot like a face mask? One German company is now producing both. The story after this short break. Welcome back to Good Food. Weeks ago, when it became apparent that masks would be part of our lives for a while, I started looking around the house to see what I had that I could repurpose just until I could buy suitable masks. I'm sure I am not alone in reaching for that ubiquitous Melitta coffee filter and sticking my face into it. I was kind of tickled to learn that the German company stepped up in a big way to create supplies of medical-grade masks that are in such low supply around the world. Christopher Schutze reported on why the company was so well-suited to find a solution. Hi, Christopher.
Hi.
Talk to us about the German coffee filter company, Melitta. Who was Melitta?
Melitta was this apparently incredible woman who 112 years ago came up with the idea of making a coffee filter. And she actually built the thing herself, the prototype, and used a bit of blotting paper from her son's notebook, I guess, to build the first ever disposable coffee filter. You know, people used to, in Germany as well, used to drink the sort of percolated coffee where you just mix the coffee and the grinds in with the water and you'd boil it. And then you'd have sort of these old metal filters, but they wouldn't get all the bits out. And she said she was tired of that taste of that sort of the coffee grind. So that's why she invented it.
Really incredible. How many masks is the company able to produce in a day now?
They are able to produce a bit over 1 million masks a day.
Is the mask based on the same fibers that are used in the coffee filters?
So, no, actually, the material used in the masks is the same material used in the production of vacuum bags. And they own, they also make, everyone knows that they make coffee filters. They also make these vacuum bags. And they use a special kind of microfiber. And it happens to be the same kind of microfiber that we use in these kind of medical masks.
And do they create this fiber, or do they have to rely on another supplier to get that fiber in?
I mean, that is sort of the point after researching this for a while, that this is sort of the amazing thing. They happen to have this fiber in one of their factories in Germany. Most of this fiber is actually now made in Asia. And what's happened is a lot of people have sort of said in Europe, not just in Germany, we want to make these face masks. And then they realize, you know, finding this fiber is not that easy to find lots of it. And Melitta was just in this lucky position that they said, oh, we actually have a machine that produces it in this thing that's 30 miles away, this factory that makes vacuum cleaner bags. And since it belongs to them as well, that group, they just pick up the rolls from their own factories. So they have everything they need.
That's really incredible. What is the projection of the number of masks that will be needed per year just in Germany?
There are different figures going around, and it's also changed since I've written this piece. But I think what we're talking about is about 12 to 15 billion masks.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Have you tried one of these masks?
I have indeed tried them. We had quite a difficult time getting them. We wanted to take some pictures of these masks, and the article has these beautiful pictures taken in Brooklyn of these masks. And so the company sent me these masks, and I tried to send them to New York, you know, to our photo editor. And you actually can't send safety masks out of the European Union these days because they're worried about, keeping the masks themselves. And so there was this funny bureaucratic struggle to get these like five masks to the Times just to, you know, take pictures of them, because if you wrote on the package, you know, that there were safety masks in there, they would get stopped at the customs.
Really? We're living in such odd times.
Yeah.
And what about the price? Are they competitive with masks that are being produced in Asia? And are they available to the public?
So this is the interesting thing. I think Melitta kind of did, within 3 or 4 days, they retooled the line, they made these masks, and they sort of thought of the second part of the equation, namely who would they sell it to, how much would they get for them, and so forth later. I think it was just sort of in this panic moment to show we can do it, we can make a million masks a day. I know that they are now talking about selling them, and what they're telling me in terms of price is that they want to be competitive with what masks cost before the pandemic that were made in Asia, which I don't know how much that is, 10 cents or something. They didn't name a number. They just said that what they wanted to do is basically to be able to compete with that.
Well, thank you so much for coming to talk to us about this story that's just so interesting. Thank you, Christopher.
Thank you, Evan. That was really fun.
That's Christopher Schütze of the New York Times Berlin Bureau. We've been discussing the German company Melitta and their shift from making coffee filters to masks. And that's it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can always subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, and Kenny Ng. Are you exhausted by cooking? I am. Give yourself a break and get some takeout. Organize your spice cabinet if you feel like it, and enjoy the weekend. I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.